Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In a part of the world where conflict is always at least at a slow burn and often flares into violence, how did Egypt and Israel manage to create a peace treaty that has lasted for decades? The 1978 Camp David Accords failed to accomplish a comprehensive agreement between Israelis and Palestinians over all disputed territories, but it did decide the fate of the Sinai Peninsula. And as my guest today will tell us, the fact that any deal emerged between parties with such deeply different interests is a remarkable achievement, as is the fact that that agreement has never been broken. Author Lawrence Wright tells the story almost minute by minute in his new book, 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 7 at the Huckaday School. Larry, welcome back to Think.
Oh, it's so great to be back. Thanks.
It really is true. The remarkable thing about the Camp David Accords is there were so many reasons why they might not have happened. Can you start by talking a little bit about the conflict specifically between Israel and Egypt in the decades that preceded 1978?
In 1947, the United Nations decided to partition what was a mandate of Palestine into two parts, a state for the Jews and a state for the Arabs. And in May of 1948, the state of Israel came into being, and five Arab armies attacked immediately. It wasn't just Israel. It was a land grab for Palestine. So Jordan took the West Bank, Egypt took Gaza, and Israel took the rest, and that was the end of Palestine. But then in 1956, there was the Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal, and Egypt and France owned it, and they were upset with that. So they conspired with Israel to provoke a war in which they would seize the canal again. And President Eisenhower was so angry at this that he ordered them out of, you know, Egypt, returned the canal, and Israel had to return the Sinai. And that's how America came into possession of the Middle East portfolio, for better or worse. And then in 1967, that was a seminal year. It was just before 1967, Jews in Israel thought they were trapped, you know, that it was just another big ghetto. And they, you know, here they are in the middle of the Arab world, such a hostile environment. They were immigrating out of Israel in huge numbers. And the drumbeats of war were coming up. They were digging mass graves in the city parks, trenches, you know, to bury thousands of. That was a mentality. And then in 6 days, Israel defeated, you know, three Arab armies. It really, you call it the Six-Day War, but it was over in the first hour when they wiped out the Egyptian Air Force. And it was such a stunning reversal that Jews began streaming into Israel thinking that prophecy was being fulfilled. Christians believed that too, you know, that the end of days is coming. And then for Muslims, it was a time when they began to consider that God might have turned against them. And many Muslims asked the question, why would that be? And the answer for them was that we weren't pure enough. We weren't fundamental enough. And that's when radical Islam got stirred into life and began to express itself in acts of terror. And then in 1973, to the shock of the Israelis, President Anwar Sadat of Egypt sent his vast Egyptian army across the Sinai Canal, something that the Israelis thought couldn't happen, and Syria attacked at the same time. So that was 4 years before they met in Camp David. And so the wounds of war were still very fresh. But the first 30 years that I've just described of Israel's existence was one of almost continual warfare.
What was at stake for Begin and Sadat back home, depending on the outcome of the accords?
Well, Begin came to Camp David thinking he really didn't have to sign anything. He thought it would last for a day or two, and that they could, you know, agree to talk some further. You know, that nobody in his delegation thought that he would stay there for 13 days and wind up surrendering the Sinai Peninsula. His entire career had been about expanding the land of Israel and making a safe zone for Jews around the world. That was everything in his life had been pointed at. The idea that he'd give up a single millimeter of land was really extraordinary. And then for Sadat, he was alone in Egypt, or even in the whole Arab world, in believing that peace with Israel was possible or even desirable. And you know, two of his foreign ministers resigned when he went to Jerusalem, one after the other. The third one resigned at Camp David. He had no support within his government, and in the Arab world, they all turned their backs on him.
How well acquainted was Carter with the two leaders in question?
When Carter came into the White House, he said that he told me that he thought that God had put him in that high office in order to bring peace to the Holy Land. I tell you, when he told Walter Mondale, his vice president, that on the first day in office, Mondale was shocked and a little worried. Nobody wanted Carter to attempt that, especially in his first term. It turned out his only term.
And there was a lot going on domestically at the time.
Yeah, well, the prime rate was 20%, if you can remember. The gas lines, double-digit inflation, the Shah was being overthrown. It was a tumultuous period of time. And yet Carter had his head set that he was going to try to bring peace. And he began interviewing Middle East leaders that were coming to Washington to meet the new president. And he was quite dismayed until he met Anwar Sadat. And Jimmy Carter fell in love. I mean, he often said that he loved Anwar Sadat. And they clearly had a very intense friendship. I think they had a lot in common. I mean, they were farm boys from very poor rural areas. And Jimmy had grown up in a little hamlet of Archery near Plains. The Carters were the only white family, and 55 other black families, and all of his friends were black. And Anwar Sadat was black. His mother was the daughter of an emancipated African slave, and he inherited her dark coloring. So I think it kindled some feeling of fraternity in Carter. But
he didn't love Menachem Begin.
Oh, no. Begin returned the favor. Begin came to the White House. He had just been elected himself in what was the most surprising election in Israel's history. It's called the reversal. And it's a turning point in many ways. I mean, the party that he created, Likud, has dominated Israel ever since. But up until that point, Menachem Begin was, you know, the first Holocaust survivor. He was the first believing Jew. Up until that point, they were all secular figures. The man he beat, Shimon Peres, someone asked him, what happened? It was such an extraordinary surprise. And Peres said, I guess the Jews beat the Israelis.
Their personalities, Begin's and Sadat's, were just very different. It's almost hard to imagine them agreeing on what to have for dinner, let alone something of this import.
Well, Carter had a naive and mistaken idea that he could just get these two honorable men behind closed doors. They would get to know each other, they'd like each other, they'd trust each other, and they would find their own way to peace. And he would act as a kind of camp counselor. And after the second day, he had to physically separate them. Rosalind said that they were screaming at each other at the top of their lungs. They hated each other. And, they had very little in common. The CIA analyst Carter had asked for a portfolio of analysis on their personalities. And some of the analysts looked at these, the two character studies and thought they should never be in the same room together. And they turned out to be correct in that regard.
And it was Rosalind Carter's idea that the talks would take place at Camp David.
Yeah. Jimmy Carter had this notion that he would have an international conference in Geneva, and nobody wanted to go. It was a mistaken idea. It was problematic about, how were the Palestinians going to be represented, if at all? Were the Russians going to be there? It never came off, and he was discouraged, and he and Rosalind went to Camp David, and he was expressing his dismay, and she said, well, why don't you bring them here? So in many ways, Rosalind Carter is the unacknowledged author of this accord.
Was there something special about Camp David?
Yes, Camp David is, is remote. It's on a wooded hilltop in the Catoctin Mountains in Maryland. It's a brief helicopter ride from the White House. And when Carter came into office, you know, he was very penurious. And, you know, one of his first actions was to sell the presidential yacht. And so he wanted to make a show of economy in these troubled economic times. So the next thing he did, he's going to sell Camp David. And his military attaché said, Mr. President, have you ever been to Camp David? No. Do you know what's there? Cabins. Well, yeah, there are cabins, but it's also there's a vast underground nuclear bunker where Carter might retreat during a, you know, in an apocalyptic situation.
You might wish you'd hung on to the property.
Right, yeah. Indeed. And you know, it was there were reasons to hang on to Camp David beyond just the, you know, comfort of getting away for the weekend. So he went one weekend to investigate, and after that, you know, he and Rosalynn went there frequently. It was, you know, the only place, and it's proved true for, I guess, all presidents going back to Franklin Roosevelt, who first acquired the property, that it's a break where you can just be yourself for a while.
We're speaking this hour with journalist and author Lawrence Wright. His new book is called 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. He'll speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth at the Hockaday School. That event is free, but you do need to reserve tickets online. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes with Lawrence Wright.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Lawrence Wright about his new book, 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 7 at the Hockaday School. You can find details about that online. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet over at Chris Boyd Think. Larry, one thing that these two men, Sadat and Begin, had in common was that they both recognized the value of a good relationship with the United States.
And that became the critical part of it. You know, Sadat had an idea when it came to Camp David that peace may not be possible. In fact, it was unlikely. But maybe he could improve his relationship with the United States so that it would come to mirror his friendship with Jimmy Carter. And in that way, maybe edge Israel a little bit out of the picture. And Egypt would become America's main ally in the Middle East. And Begin came to Camp David, you know, without really thinking that peace was a possibility, but not really considering the consequences. After the fifth day, Carter put forward an American plan, something he didn't want to do, something Begin begged him not to do. But it put America's relationship with these two countries on the line. And when, for instance, when Sadat got so frustrated, he ordered the helicopter and packed his bags. He was out of there. Carter told me he had never been angrier in his life. He went to Sadat and said, if you do this, our relationship between our two countries is finished. Our friendship is over. Egypt will be alone and helpless in the world for a generation. Do you really want to do this? From, you know, it was a come to Jesus moment, mm-hmm. and the sort that little Jimmy Carter learned in the church, and it had an effect. And then when Begin, on a couple of occasions, also indicated that he was going to leave, Carter told him, I will tell the American people who's responsible for the breakdown in the talks. I'll go to Congress tomorrow. And he even had a speechwriter draw up a speech in which he was going to ask the Israeli people to vote down their government. I mean, he was really playing hardball. Both of these men wanted peace. They could not make peace with each other, but they could make concessions to the United States that allowed that peace to happen. That's what occurred.
How did Carter realize, because it sounds like it wasn't the case at the outset, that he would have to use sticks as well as carrots?
Well, you know, they were leaving. He had to physically block them on one occasion from leaving the room, and then from leaving the camp, he had to pull out every single arsenal he could, every weapon in his arsenal that he could. But finally, it became those kinds of threats. And, he was punished for that. I mean, the idea that that Jimmy Carter had bullied Israel into this agreement is something that still hangs over these talks. And right after that, many Jews turned against him. He was the first Democratic nominee to not gain a majority of the Jewish vote. But on the other hand, no other president, I think, has ever given Israel something as great as peace with Egypt.
So there were threats to leave. There was bad behavior on all sides.
Yes, indeed.
Can you talk a little bit about the teams that were the sort of entourages that the two Middle East leaders brought with them and the roles they played in that?
They were completely opposite, like mirror images of each other. The Israelis, some of the most important figures in Israel's history, Moshe Dayan, Ezra Weissman, people like that were part, Aaron Barak, who became the Supreme Court justice in Israel. These that formed the core of the delegation. They were all far more in favor of peace than was Menachem Begin, their leader. And yet, Begin knew that, and he picked them. And so I think he was picking people that would help him make a decision that he was very reluctant to make. And I think he was terrified, that the responsibility, he lost his family in the Holocaust. I mean, the idea that he would do anything that would endanger Jews, must have weighed terribly on him. So in some ways, his delegation enabled him to make a decision he didn't want to make.
Let me jump in here for a minute. Can you talk about why he was concerned genuinely that this would endanger Jews? This was more than just giving back territory.
Well, the Sinai Peninsula is 130 miles of sand, but it formed a strategic barrier between Israel and the main Egyptian forces. Sinai had been a historic concourse for invading armies for millennia. And so many Israelis felt that, why would you trade that for a piece of paper that says peace on it? We can easily be torn up. The Sinai with Israeli settlements, there were a number of settlements, that's our security belt. And Begin was facing a lot of opposition, especially in his own party, with the idea that he would surrender that. A clean shave is what Sadat demanded. No Israeli settlements, and there were air bases and so on. He wanted it completely clean. And that was a real hard sell for Begin. As for the Egyptians, they were unanimous and almost unanimous in opposing Sadat and his quest for peace. Many of them frightened for their lives that they were even involved in this. And I think it was true that Sadat signed his death certificate when he initialed those Camp David Accords. But his foreign minister, Mohammed Ibrahim Kamel, resigned at Camp David. There was so much dissension, and Carter could see it. One night, Carter woke up convinced that the Egyptian delegation was going to murder Sadat, their leader, at Camp David. And he woke up Zbigniew Brzezinski, his national security advisor, at 4 in the morning, and Brzezinski was running around Camp David in his pajamas trying to reinforce the security around Sadat's cabin to protect him from his own people. It was, the passions were really running high and dangerously so.
What kind of a blow was it to Carter when Sadat was assassinated?
Oh, it was he felt, he'd lost a great friend, his greatest friend in terms of international diplomacy, and the man who made history with him. He felt more at home with Anwar Sadat than any other foreign leader. And I asked him, he did not seem to feel responsible for Sadat's death, in a sense that, Sadat wanted peace, and I suppose he knew what kind of price he might have to pay.
Tell us about the last day of the negotiations.
Oh, it was crazy. Saturday night, the night before, the 12th night, Carter thought he had an agreement. And the next day, Sunday, the 13th day, all that remained was the signing at the White House. The networks had been notified. that the president was going to interrupt the Emmys that night, and they were setting up the tables and chairs in the East Room. And Carter had been asked by Sadat to write a side letter about East Jerusalem. Now, side letters, there are many side letters in the Accords. They have no legal standing. They just state the policy of the different governments in cases where we don't really agree. And on the subject of East Jerusalem, Carter quoted three American UN ambassadors going back to Arthur Goldberg saying East Jerusalem is occupied territory. Well, that letter came into Begin's hands, and he demanded that Carter withdraw it. He said, you know, you've betrayed me. And Carter was stunned, you know, because it doesn't affect the treaty. But he couldn't withdraw it because he had promised Sadat. So Begin said, the signing is off. No agreement. And Carter went back to his cabin more depressed than he had ever been in his life, because the talks had not only broken down, they were a fiasco at this point. And so it happened that there had been a photograph of the three men sitting on the porch of Aspen Lodge, the presidential cabin, while they're negotiating. And Carter had copies made up for Begin's nine grandchildren and had inscribed them. His secretary had called Israel and gotten their names. And then he realized he had to go back to Begin's cabin and give him, and he did not want to see that man ever again in his life, nor did Begin want to see Carter again. He received Carter absolutely frigidly. Mm-hmm. And so Carter, you know, essentially the conversation was, thank you, goodbye, Mr. President. And Carter handed him the manila envelopes with the photograph in them. And Begin glanced at the first picture, and it was inscribed to his granddaughter, Michal, and the next one to his grandson, Yonatan. And he began to weep. And Carter also started to cry. And he said, I had hoped to write, this is where your grandfather and I made peace in the Middle East. And then he went back to his cabin to tell Sadat that there was no signing that night. And the phone rang, and Begin said he would sign.
You know, you hear that story, Larry, and it's such a, those are such human moments.
Yeah.
And it seems like so often diplomacy, at least the diplomacy that we hear about publicly, is done in these very formalized ways in which the humanity is sort of stripped out of everything.
Right.
And maybe what it requires is people talking to one another, connecting.
You know, history turned on that moment. You know, it's fascinating to think about it because if you spend a lot of time in the Middle East, one lesson you learn is that things can always get worse. And just imagine how much worse they would be in the Middle East if Egypt and Israel were still at war. But there hasn't been a single violation of that portion of the treaty in 35 years. There's another portion of the treaty that has to do with the Palestinians, and that's never been fully implemented. And that's the missing piece of the peace in the Middle East.
Do you think it's impossible?
No. It's, you know, I think the thinking that it's impossible is a real enemy of peace. You know, it happens that I'm the same age as Israel. I was born in 1947, the same year that the UN divided up mandated Palestine. And so in my lifetime, I've grown up in the segregated South, and we have a black man who's president. It was a time of apartheid in South Africa, long since swept away. And it was a period of the Cold War, and now the Soviet Union is dissolved. Now, history changes, but the concept that this particular conflict is eternal and entitled to be so, I take great issue with, because for one thing, Camp David proves it is possible for Arabs and Jews to make peace. They did it, and it's successful. So it can happen again, but what was true, you know, these were very flawed men at Camp David. They were by no means perfect, but they had a lot of political courage, and they were willing to make the sacrifices that peace demands. And it hurts. You know, if you go to Israel and Egypt today, you'll find many people hate this peace. But the alternative is unending strife. And I think the lesson is that peace is worth that price.
We're speaking with author Lawrence Wright about his new book, 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. We'll resume our conversation in a few minutes. If you'd like to join it, you may call 1-800-933-5372. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Lawrence Wright. He's got a new book out called 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 7 at the Hockaday School. You can find information about how to get a free ticket online. If you would like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Paul in North Branch, who says President Carter is in Dallas for the next few days. He is building and renovating homes. Has President Carter been invited to tonight's presentation at Hockaday? And are you two on good terms?
I didn't know he was in town until just now. But yeah, we're on good terms. This project began as a play.
Yeah.
It was commissioned by the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. And President Carter and Mrs. Carter came on opening night and put a little pressure on the actors and on me. and Carter was very anxious about how he might be portrayed. And Gerald Rafshoon, who was Carter's media advisor in the White House, said he had never seen Jimmy Carter cry. And after he was openly weeping, as was Rosalind, and they came up on the stage to greet the actors, and he came up to Hallie Foote, who played Rosalind, and he took her hand and said, "I fell in love with you again tonight." So he loved the play, and I haven't heard from him about the book, so I haven't any idea how he's responded to it.
How do you, what in terms of approaching storytelling, creating a dramatic narrative has got to be different from creating a nonfiction book, and I wonder how you decide what can go in and what can stay out when you're making a play. What has to be there?
Well, the most important thing on a play is who's on stage, mm-hmm. and I knew Carter, Begin, and Sadat had to be on the stage, and so when I went to Plains and Gerald Rafshoon took me down to introduce me and. President and Mrs. Carter sat in their very modest house they live in and sat on this blue chintz couch. And Rafshoon says, "Mr. President, Larry works for The New Yorker. He recently wrote an article about Scientology." "Oh, I read that. I found it most intriguing." And Rosalind turns around and says, "Since when did you start reading The New Yorker?" And I thought, boy, I found my fourth character. Rosalind was born in the house next door to Jimmy Carter. And, you know, he's just turned 90 this week. And so they've known each other for almost a century, but they still have a very interesting and vital relationship.
And then when you went to, did you know that you would turn the project into a full-length book?
Well, I thought about it as I was researching this. I went to Israel and Egypt, and I treated it as I would a New Yorker story or a book. Just, you know, dive in and research it like crazy. And I realized that the book that I would have adapted didn't exist. You know, that normally you would have your eye out for such a thing. And William Quant, who's a National Security Council member under Carter, had written a very fine diplomatic history of the event. But there was a book in Arabic by Muhammad Ibrahim Kamel, Sadat's foreign minister. But pretty much that was it. There were memoirs, you know, that mentioned Camp David. But this was one of the great diplomatic triumphs of the 20th century. And, you know, how it could be, I think Carter was so unpopular when he left office that people just didn't want to credit, you know, this signal event that has really defined the Middle East.
At the time the accord was signed, do you think the parties present imagined that it would last this long and on into the future? Or do you think that they thought of it as a sort of a temporary step on a longer path?
No, I think that, you know, Moshe Dayan, who was the defense minister and was at Camp David, said it, you know, at the signing that, you know, he remarked that it was a good treaty. It, you know, had been hard fought, but it had been carefully thought out, you know, with all these safeguards and, you know, this spells out all the, the demilitarization, everything that, you know, you would want to have in a peace treaty had been very carefully considered. So, you know, it was not a gamble. It was a real treaty.
Sometimes even people of great faith are made uncomfortable hearing a national leader saying they feel as if they were called by God to do something. Can you give us some more perspective on how really each of these three individuals saw their sort of holy destiny with regard to these 13 days in September 1978?
Yeah, you know, I've always been interested in religion and how it plays such a role in people's lives and not just, you know, in societies. Because people who have strong political beliefs, it may not affect their behavior at all, but if you find people who have strong religious beliefs, usually their lives, you know, are deeply influenced, and that's true of societies as well. And Carter grew up in, you know, very, you know, deep Baptist, and when he was a boy, he knew the geography of the Holy Land better than he knew that of the United States. You know, he very, very religious man.
But didn't travel there until much later in life.
1973, when he was governor in Georgia. But, you know, and the only Jew he knew was his uncle Louis Bronstein, who was an insurance salesman in Chattanooga and could chin himself with one hand, which made a big impression on him. And the first time he made an Arab was at the Daytona 500. So, but he was, you know, he really believed that God had engineered, you know, him being elected in part to bring peace to the Holy Land. Sadat, when he went to Jerusalem and extended this offer of peace in 1977, he said that God had placed him in this position of responsibility for the Muslims. And he was a very pious man. I used to live in Cairo. I taught at the American University there when he became president. And he had the prayer mark, that dark callus on his forehead, which is now common, but was unusual then. And people made fun of it because his open piety that Sadat, he called himself the first man of Islam. And then Begin was not pious, but he was observant. And, you know, in political Israel at the time, it was dominated by very secular people. And Begin was very much at home in religious environment. He was well-schooled in the Torah and the Bible. And I think each of these men saw themselves in a prophetic tradition. But, you know, it's interesting to think they were three men of religion. They got together to try to resolve a problem that religion itself had largely caused.
What can we learn from what happened at Camp David to apply to ongoing and future peace efforts for the Middle East?
Well, you know, start with the idea that, you know, you often hear that you need a partner for peace, as if there are perfect partners. Anwar Sadat was, you know, we see him now as a kind of idealistic figure, but he was a Nazi collaborator. He had been a political assassin. And Begin was head of a terrorist organization, Irgun, and Carter was a weak and unpopular president.
Though it's not really the dream team, if you describe it that way.
No, can you imagine a less likely cast to get together and make a durable peace in the Middle East? But they did it. The other thing is timing. We talked about, you know, what a difficult time it was for Carter with, you know, the economy being so rocky and the Shah going down. For Begin, you know, people in Israel were still reeling from the 73 war. And for Sadat, you know, the Arab world was, you know, unanimous in its hatred and intolerance for the state of Israel. So timing was not, you know, not propitious. And moreover, 13 days, and of course, nobody knew it was going to take 13 days. But, you know, Carter budgeted it 3 or 4. But to imagine three world leaders taking 2 weeks off in a very uncertain quest to make peace. And finally, America's role was crucial at Camp David. there wouldn't be a peace if Carter hadn't put America's role on the table. But I think, you know, there's a lesson. Those are the successes, but there's a lesson in the failure as well, because the portion dealing with the Palestinians has never been implemented. And they look at the consequences. You know, the Middle East has continued to be roiled by this conflict. It has spilled over into the rest of the world, as it must, you know, as long as this conflict between Arabs and Jews continues, then, you know, there are going to be consequences for the rest of the world. And we have to take that seriously. As, you know, we should try to resolve it for the sake of peace among them, but it does affect world affairs. And, you know, there's very little effort directed in that direction right now.
Lawrence Wright is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His new book is called 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 7 at the Hockaday School. Larry, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Chris.